Hancock. "'Igor said he'd never done such an easy reattachment.' "'Nevertheless, it's truncheons only tonight, Andy, unless I give any other order, okay?'
"'Understood, Commander Vimes. I've just got a new truncheon, as a matter of fact.'
Some sixth sense made Vimes say, "'Oh, really? May I see?'
"'Right here, sir.'
Hancock pulled out what looked to Vimes like two truncheons joined together with a length of chain.
"'They're Agatean numbnuts, sir. No sharp edges at all.'
Vimes gave them an experimental swing and hit his own elbow. He handed them back quickly.
"'Rather you than me, lad. Still, I suppose they'll make a troll stop and think.'
Mr. Pessimal was staring in horror, not least because Wayward Wood had just missed him.
"'Oh, this is Mr. Pessimal, Andy,' said Vimes. "'He's finding out how we do things. Mr. Hancock is one of our keenest special constables, Mr. Pessimal.
"'Nice to meet you, Mr. Pessimal,' said Hancock. "'If you need any weapons, catalogues, I'm your man.'
Vimes moved on quickly, just in case the man drew those swords again and run up against slightly more reassuring figure.
"'And here we have Mr. Boggis,' he said. "'Good to see you. Mr. Boggis is president of the Guild of Thieves, Mr. Pessimal.'
Mr. Boggis saluted proudly. He had accepted a chainmail jacket from Fred, but no power in the world would have parted him from his brown bowler hat. Any power nevertheless inclined to try would in any case have to contend with the narrow-eyed, stony-jawed men on either side of him, who had eschewed any weapons or armour. One of them was cleaning his fingernails with a cut-throat razor. In a strange but very definite way they looked much more dangerous even than Special Constable Hancock.
"'And also Vinnie Know-Ears Ludd and Harry can't-remember-his nickname Jones, I see,' Vimes went on. "'You brought your bodyguards, Mr. Boggis?'
"'Vinny and Harry, like to get out in the fresh air, Mr. Vimes,' said Mr. Boggis. "'And I see you've got your own bodyguard, then?'
He beamed down on A.E. Pessimal and then grinned at Vimes.
"'You have to watch them little bantam fighters, Mr. Vimes. They can have the nose off your face quicker and wink. I can tell a killing cove when I see one, eh? Best of luck to you, Mr. Pessimal.'
Vimes bustled the astonished man away before Mr. Boggis was killed on the spot by the god of overacting, and almost walked into the one special who could be guaranteed not to talk too much.
"'And here, Mr. Pessimal, here we have the university librarian,' he said. "'Good man in a melee, eh?'
But that's not a man. That's an orangutan, Pongo Pongo, native of Bang Bang Duck and nearby islands.'
"'Ook,' said the librarian, patting A.E. Pessimal on the head and handing him a banana skin.
"'Well done, A.E.,' said Vimes. "'Not many people get that right.'
And so Vimes dragged the inspector back through the crowd of damp, armoured men, introducing him right and left. Then he pushed him into a corner and, to faint stunned protestations, dragged the mail shirt over his head.
"'You stick close behind me, Mr. Pessimal,' he said, as the man tried to move. "'It could get a bit sticky later on. The trolls are up in the plaza and the dwarfs are down in the square, and both of them are drinking enough courage to have a good scrap. That's why we'll be lining up in the cham, right between them, the thin brown streak.
The dwarfs favour battle axes, the trolls go in for clubs. Our weapon of first resort will be our truncheons.' And our weapon of last resort is our feet. That is to say, we'll run like hell.
But you have swords, A.E. Pessimal managed.
We have swords, Acting Constable. Yes, that is a fact, but poking holes in citizens is watch brutality, and we don't want any of that now, do we? Let's get going. I wouldn't like you to miss anything.
He harried the man again, out into the street, and the stream of watchmen heading for the cham. Apart from them, the street was empty. Ankh-Morpork people had an instinct for staying indoors when there were too many battle-axes and spiky clubs out there. The cham was simply a very, very wide road, once intended for ceremonial parades, a hangover from the days when the city had much to be ceremonious about. Drizzle filled it now, and did not do much more than wet the pavements and reflect the light of the flares along the barricades. Barricades, well, that's what they were called on the watch infantry. Ha! Lengths of wood painted in black and yellow stripes and mounted on trestles were not barricades, not to anyone who'd been behind a real one, which was built of rubbish and furniture and barrels and fear and bowel-knotting defiance. No, these simple things were the physical symbol of an idea. It was a line in the sand. It said, thus far and no further. It said, this is where the law is. Step over this line and you've gone beyond the law. Step over this line with your massive axes and huge morning stars and heavy, heavy spiky clubs, and we happy few who stand here with our wooden truncheons, well, you just better not step over the line, okay? The yellow and black edges of the law had been set about 12 feet apart, giving plenty of room for two lines of watchmen standing back to back, facing outwards. Vimes dragged Mr. Pessimal into the centre of the cham between the lines and let him go.
"Any questions?" he said, as latecomers jostled past them to take up their positions.
The little man stared toward the distant plaza, where the trolls had lit a big fire, and then turned to look the other way at the square, where the dwarfs had lit several fires. There was the sound of singing.
"Oh, yes, we'll get the singing first. At this point it's all about getting the blood pounding, you see," Vimes added helpfully. "Songs about heroes, great victories, killing your enemies and drinking out of their warm skulls, that sort of thing."
"And then they'll attack us?" said A.E. Pessimal.
"Well, not as such," Vimes conceded. "They'll try to attack the other bunch, and we're in the way."
"They won't go around, perhaps," said A.E. Pessimal hopefully.
"I doubt it. They won't be in the mood for narrow alleys. They'll be thinking in straight lines. Charge and yell, they'll say. That's the way."
"Ah, there's the university over there," said A.E. Pessimal, as if noticing the huge bulk of unseen university for the very first time. "Surely, though, the wizards could magic their weapons out of their hands, possibly leaving them with all their fingers? Magic them into the cells? Turn them all into ferrets? And what then, Mr. Pessimal?"
Vimes lit a cigar, cupping the match in his hand so that the flame made his face glow briefly.
"Shall we follow where magic leads us? Wave a wand, eh, to find out who's guilty, and what of? Magic men good? The innocent would have nothing to fear, do you think? I wouldn't bet tuppence, Mr. Pessimal. Magic's a little bit alive, a little bit tricky. Just when you think you've got it by the throat, it bites you in the arse. No magic in my watch, Mr. Pessimal. We use good, old-fashioned policing."
"But there are lots of them, Commander."
"About 1,000 altogether, I reckon," said Vimes placidly. "Plus who knows how many more out there will wail in if we let it get out of hand. This is just the hotheads and the gangs right now."
But can't you just leave them to it?"
"No, Mr. Pessimal, because that'd be what we in the Watch call complete and utter bloody chaos, and it will not stop, and it will get bigger very quickly. We have to finish it right now, so—"
There was a thud from the direction of the plaza. It was loud enough to echo around the buildings.
"What was that?"
A.E. Pessimal said, looking around hurriedly.
"Oh, that was to be expected," said Vimes.
Pessimal relaxed very slightly.
"It was?"
"Yeah, it's the Gahanka, the troll war beat," said Vimes. "They say that within 10 minutes of hearing it, you're dead."
Behind Pessimal, Detritus grinned, the torchlight turning his diamond teeth into rubies.
"Is that true?"
"I shouldn't think so," said Vimes. "And now, please excuse me for a while, Acting Constable Pessimal. I'll leave you in the good hands of Sergeant Detritus while I talk to my men. Stiffen their sinews, that sort of thing."
He moved away quickly. He told himself he shouldn't be doing this to the inspector, who was just a clerk in the wrong place, and probably wasn't a bad man. The trouble was, the trolls up in the plaza probably weren't bad trolls, and the dwarfs down in the square probably weren't bad dwarfs either. People who probably weren't bad could kill you. The troll beat boomed around the city as Vimes reached Fred Colon.
"I see they're giving us the old Gahanka then, Mr. Vimes," said the sergeant with nervous cheerfulness.
"Yep, they'll be charging pretty soon, I expect."
Vimes screwed up his eyes, trying to see figures around the distant glow. Trolls didn't charge fast, but when they charged it was like a wall getting nearer. Extending a hand and shouting "Halt!" in a firm, authoritative voice probably would not be sufficient.
"You thinking about another barricade, Mr. Vimes?" said Fred.
"Hm?"
said Vimes, dismissing the mental picture of himself laminated to the street.
"Barricades, sir," Colon prompted. "More than 30 years ago."
Vimes gave a curt nod.
Oh, yes, he remembered the Glorious Revolution. It hadn't really been a revolution, and it had been glorious only if you thought an early grave was glorious. Men had died there, too, because of other men who, bar one or two, probably weren't bad.
"Yes," he said, "and it seems like only yesterday."
Every day, he thought, it seems like only yesterday.
"Remember old Sergeant Keel? He pulled off a few tricks that night."
Sergeant Colon's voice, like A.E. Pessimal's, had a curiously hopeful tone. Vimes nodded.
"I suppose you wouldn't have one or two up your sleeve too, sir,"
Fred went on, the hope now naked and unashamed.
"You know me, Fred. Always willing to learn," said Vimes vaguely.
He strolled on, nodding to watchmen he knew, slapping others on the back, and trying not to get trapped in anyone's gaze. Every face was in some way a reflection of the face of Fred Colon. He could practically see their thoughts, while the thud of 500 clubs hitting the stone in unison banged on the eardrums like a hammer.
"You have got it sorted, haven't you, Mr. Vimes?" We're not really going to be stuck here like the meat in a sandwich, right? It's a trick, yes? It is a trick, isn't it, sir?
I hope it is, Vimes thought.
But one way or another, the watch has to be here. That's the bloody truth of it. Something had changed in the rhythm of the Gahanka. You had to be listening, but some of the clubs were hitting the ground just ahead or just after the beat.
Ah, he reached Cheery and Carrot, who were staring at the distant fires of the dwarfs.
We think we might be getting a result, sir, said Carrot.
I damn well hope so. What's happening with the dwarfs?
Not so much singing, sir,
Cheery reported.
Glad to hear it.
We could handle them, though, couldn't we, sir, said Carrot. With the golem officers on our side, too, if it came to it?
Of course we couldn't, Vimes's mind supplied. Not if they mean it. What we could is die valiantly. I've seen men die valiantly. There's no future in it.
I don't want it to come to it, Captain, Vimes stopped. Her deeper shadow had moved among the shadows.
What's the password? He said quickly.
The shadowy figure, who was cloaked and hooded, hesitated.
Password? Excuse me, I've got it written down somewhere, it began.
Okay, Igor, come on in, said Carrot.
How did you know it was me, sir?
Said Igor, ducking under the barricade.
Your aftershave, said Vimes, winking at the captain. How did it go?
Just as you said, sir, said Igor, pushing his hood back. Incidentally, sir, I have scrubbed the slab well, and my cousin Igor is standing by to lend a hand, in case of any little accidents, sir.
Thank you for thinking of that, Igor, said Vimes, as if Igor's ever thought of anything else. I hope it won't be needed.
He looked up and down the cham. The rain was falling harder now. Just once the copper's friend had turned up when he really needed it. Rain tended to dampen martial enthusiasm.
"Anyone seen Nobby?" he said.
A voice from the shadow said,
"Here, Mr. Vimes. Been here 5 minutes."
"Why didn't you sing out, then?"
"Couldn't remember the password, sir. Thought I'd wait till I heard Igor say it."
"Oh, come on in. Did it work?"
"Better than you'd imagine, sir," said Nobby, rain pouring down his cloak.
Vimes stood back.
"Okay, lads, then this is it. Carrot and Cheery, you head for the dwarfs. Me and Detritus will take the trolls. You know the drill. Lines to advance slowly and no edged weapons. I repeat, no edged weapons. Let's do this like coppers, okay? On the signal."
He hurried back up the line of barricades as fast as the stir ran along the ranks of the watchmen. Detritus was waiting stoically. He grunted when Vimes arrived.
"Clubs have just about stopped, sir," he reported.
"I heard, Sergeant."
Vimes took off his oiled leather cloak and hung it on the barricade. He needed his arms free.
"By the way, how did it go in Turnagain Lane?" he said, stretching his arms.
"Oh, wonderful, sir," said Detritus happily. 6 alchemists and 50 pounds of fresh slide. In and out, quick and sweet, all banged up in a tenty."
"Didn't know what hit him, eh?" said Vimes.
Detritus looked mildly offended at this.
"Oh, no, sir," he said. "I made sure they knew I hit them."
And then Vimes spotted Mr. Pessimal, still where he had left him, his face a pale disk in the shadows. Well, enough of that game. Maybe the little tit would have learned something, standing here in the rain, waiting to be caught between a couple of screaming mobs. Maybe he'd had time to wonder what it was like to spend your life going through moments like that. A bit harder than pushing paper, eh?
"If I was you, I'd just wait here, Mr. Pessimal," he said, as kindly as he could manage. "This might be a bit rough in parts."
"No, Commander," said A.E. Pessimal, looking up.
"What?"
"I have been paying attention to what has been said, and intend to face the foe, Commander," said A.E. Pessimal.
"Now, see here, Mr. See here, A.E., said Vimes, putting his hand on the little man's shoulder.
He stopped. A.E. Pessimal was trembling so much that his chainmail was faintly jingling. Vimes persevered.
"Look, go on home, eh? This isn't where you belong."
He patted the shoulder a few times, totally nonplussed.
"Commander Vimes?" snapped the inspector.
Yes.
A.E. Pessimal turned up to Vimes a face wetter than the drizzle rightly accounted for.
"I am an acting constable, am I not?"
"Well, yes, I know I said that, but I did not expect you to take it seriously."
"I am a serious man, Commander Vimes, and there is no place I would rather be now than here,"
Acting Constable Pessimal said, his teeth chattering,
"and no time I'd rather be here than now. Let's do this, shall we?"
Vimes looked at Detritus, who shrugged his massive shoulders. Something was happening here, in the mind of a little man whose back he could possibly break with one hand.
"Oh, well, if you say so," he said hopelessly. "You heard the inspector, Sergeant Detritus. Let's do this, shall we?"
The troll nodded, and turned to face the distant troll encampment. He cupped his hands and bellowed a string of trollish, which bounced off the buildings.
"'It's something we can all understand, perhaps,' said Vimes as the echoes died away.
A.E. Pessimal stepped forward, taking a deep breath.
"'Come on, if you think you're hard enough!'
he screamed wildly. Vimes coughed. "'Thank you, Mr. Pessimal,' he said weakly. "'I imagine that should do it.' The moon was somewhere beyond the clouds, but Angua didn't need to see it. Carrot once had a special watch made for her birthday. It was a little moon that turned right around black side and white side every 28 days. It must have cost him a lot of money, and Angua now wore it on her collar, the one item of clothing that she could wear all month round. She couldn't bring herself to tell him she didn't need it. You knew what was happening. It was hard to know much else right now, because she was thinking with her nose. That was the problem with the wolf times, the nose took charge. Currently, Angua was searching the alleys around Treacle Street, spiralling out from the dwarf mine. She prowled onwards in a world of colour, smells overlaid one another, drifting and persisting. The nose was also the only organ that can see backwards in time. She'd already visited the spoil heap on the waste ground. There was the smell of troll there. It had got out that way, but there was no point in following a trail that cold. Hundreds of street trolls wore lichen and skulls these days, but the foul, oily stuff, that was a smell that was clinging to her memory. The little devils must have some other ways in, right? And you had to move the air around in a mine, right? So some trace of that oil would find its ways out along with the air. They probably wouldn't be strong, but she didn't need them to be. A trace of it was all she needed. It would be more than enough. As she padded through the alleys and leapt walls into midnight yards, she kept clenched in her jaws the little leather bag that was a friend to any thinking werewolf, such a creature being defined as one who remembers that your clothes don't magically follow you. The bag held a lightweight silk dress and a large bottle of mouthwash, which Angua considered to be the greatest invention of the last 100 years. She found what she was looking for behind Broadway. It stood out against the familiar organic smells of the city as a tiny black ribbon of stench that left zigzags in the air as breezes and the pasture of carts had dragged it this way and that. She began to move with more care. This wasn't an area like Treacle Street. People with money lived here, and they often spent that money on big dogs and disproportionate response signs in their driveways. As it was, she heard the rattle of chains and the occasional whine as she slunk along. She hated being attacked by large, ferocious dogs. It always left a mess, and the mouthwash was never strong enough. The thread of stink was floating through the railings of Empirical Crescent, one of the city's great architectural semi-precious gems. It was always hard to find people prepared to live there, however, despite the general desirable nature of the area. Tenants seldom stayed for more than a few months before moving hurriedly, sometimes leaving all their possessions behind. Empirical Crescent was just off Park Lane, in what was generally a high-rent district. The rents would have been higher still were it not for the continued existence of Empirical Crescent itself, which, despite the best efforts of the Ankh-Morpork Historical Preservation Society, had still not been pulled down. This was because it had been built by Burgholt Stutley Johnson, better known to history as Bloody Stupid Johnson. A man who combined in one frail body such enthusiasm, self-delusion, and creative lack of talent that he was, in many respects, one of the great heroes of architecture. Only Bloody Stupid Johnson could have invented the 13-inch foot and a triangle with 3 right angles in it. Only Bloody Stupid Johnson could have twisted common matter through dimensions it was not supposed to go. And only Bloody Stupid Johnson could have done all this by accident. His highly original approach to geometry was responsible for Empirical Crescent. On the outside, it was a normal terraced crescent of the period, built of honey-coloured stone with the occasional pillar or cherub nailed on. Inside, the front door of number 1 opened into the back bedroom of number 15. The ground floor front window of number 3 showed the view appropriate to the second floor of number 9, and smoke from the dining room fireplace of number 2 came out of the chimney of number 19. She sailed over the railing with silence and ease and landed on all fours on what had once been a gravel path. Residents in the Crescent seldom did much gardening, since even if you planted bulbs, you could never be sure whose garden they'd come up in. Angua followed her nose to a patch of rampant thistles. Some moulding bricks in a circle marked what must have been an old well.
The oily stink was heavy here, but there was a fresher, far more complex smell that raised the hairs on Angua's neck. There was a vampire down there. Someone had pulled away the weeds and debris, including the inevitable rotting mattress and decomposing armchair. But it was okay to throw your rubbish into the garden, because it might not be your garden you were throwing it into. Sally? What was she doing here? Angua pulled a brick out of the rotted edging and let it drop. Instead of a splash, there was a clear wooden thump. Oh, well. She went back to human to get down. Claws were fine, but some things were better done by monkeys. The sides were, of course, slimy, but so many bricks had fallen out over the years that the descent turned out to be easier than she'd expected. And it was only about 60 feet deep, built in the days when it was widely believed that any water that supported so many little whiskery swimming things must be healthy. There were fresh planks in the bottom. Someone, and surely it could only have been the dwarfs, had broken into the well down here and laid a couple of planks across it. They had dug this far and stopped. Why? Because they'd reached the well? There was dirty water, or water-like liquid, just under the planks. The tunnel was a bit wider here, and dwarfs had been here, she sniffed, a day ago no more. Yes. Dwarfs had been here, had fished around, and had then all left at once. They hadn't even bothered to tidy up. She could smell it like a picture. She crept forward, the tunnels mapping themselves in her nostrils. They weren't nicely finished like the tunnels Ardent moved in. They were rougher, with lots of zigzags and blind alleys. Rough planks and balks of timber held back the fetid mud of the plains, which was nevertheless oozing through everywhere. These tunnels weren't built to last. They were there for a quick and definitely dirty job, and all they had to do was survive until it was done. So, the diggers had been looking for something, but weren't sure where it was until they were within, what, about 20 feet of it when they'd smelled it? Detected it? The last stretch to the well was dead straight. By then they knew where they were going. Angua crept on, almost bending double to clear the low ceiling until she gave up and went back to Wolf. The tunnels straightened out, with the occasional side passage that she ignored, although they smelt long. The vampire smell was still an annoying theme in the nasal symphony, and it came close to drowning the reek of foul water oozing from the walls. Here and there, worms had colonized the ceiling. So had bats. They stirred. And then there was another scent as she passed a tunnel opening. It was quite faint, but it was unmistakably the whiff of corruption. A fresh death. 4 fresh deaths. At the end of a short side tunnel were the bodies of 3 dwarfs, half buried in mud. They glowed. Worms had no teeth, Carrot had told her. They waited until the prospective meal became runny of its own accord. And while they waited for the biggest stroke of luck ever to have come their way, they celebrated. Down here, in a world far away from the streets, the dwarfs would dissolve in light. Angua sniffed. Make that very fresh.
They found something, said a voice behind her, and then it killed them.
Angua leapt. The leap wasn't intentional. Her hindbrain arranged it all by itself. The front brain, the bit that knew that sergeants should not attempt to disembowel lance constables without provocation, tried to stop the leap in mid-air, but by then simple ballistics were in charge. All she managed was a mid-air twist and struck the soft wall with her shoulder. Wings fluttered a little way off, and there was a drawn-out, organic sound, a sound that conveyed the idea that a slaughterhouse man was having some difficulty with a tricky bit of gristle.
"You know, sergeant," said the voice of Sally, as if nothing had happened, "you werewolves have it easy. You stay one thing, and you don't have any problems with body mass. Do you know how many bats I have to become for my body weight? More than 150, that's how many. And there's always one, isn't there, that gets lost or flies the wrong way. You can't think straight unless you get your bats together. And I'm not even going to touch on the subject of re-assimilation. It's like the biggest sneeze you can think of, backwards." There was no point in modesty, not down here in the dark. Angua forced herself to change back, every brain cell piling in to outvote tooth and claw. Anger helped.
"Why the hell are you here?" she said, when she had a mouth that worked.
"I'm off duty," said Sally, stepping forward. "I thought I'd see what I could find."
She was totally naked.
"You couldn't have been so lucky," Angua growled. "Oh, I don't have your nose, sergeant,"
said Sally with a sweet smile, "but I was using 150 pretty good flying ones, and they can cover a lot of ground."
"I thought vampires could rematerialize their clothes," said Angua accusingly.
"Otto Shriek can."
"A female's can't. We don't know why. It's probably part of the whole underwired nightdress business. That's where you score again, of course. When you're in 150 bat bodies, it's quite hard to remember to keep two of them carrying a pair of pants."
Sally looked up at the ceiling and sighed. "Look, I can see where this is going. It's going to be about Captain Carrot, isn't it? I saw the way you were smiling at him. I'm sorry. We can be very personable. It's a vampire thing. You were so keen to impress him, eh? And you aren't. He's the kind of man anyone would want to impress." They watched one another warily.
"He is mine, you know," said Angua, feeling the nascent claws strain under her fingernails.
"You're his, you mean," said Sally. "You know it works like that. You trail after him."
"I'm sorry. It's a werewolf thing," Angua yelled.
"Hold it." Sally thrust both hands in front of her in a gesture of peace. "There's something we'd better sort out before this goes any further."
"Yeah?"
"Yes. We're both wearing nothing. We're standing in what, you may have noticed, is increasingly turning into mud, and we're squaring up to fight."
"Okay. But there's something missing, yes?"
"And that is?"
"A paying audience. We could make a fortune," Sally winked.
"Or we could do the job we came here to do."
Angua forced her body to relax. She should have been saying that. She was the sergeant, wasn't she?
"All right, all right," she said. "We're both here. Okay, let's leave it at that. Were you saying that these dwarfs were killed by some thing from the well?"
"Possibly. But if they were, it used an axe," said Sally. "Take a look. Scrape some of the mud away. It's been oozing over them since I arrived. That's probably why you missed it," she added generously.
Angua hauled one dwarf out of the shining slime.
"I see," she said, letting the body fall back. "This one hasn't been dead 2 days. Not much effort made to hide them, I see.
Why bother? They've stopped pumping out these tunnels. The props look pretty temporary. The mud's coming back. Besides, who'd be stupid enough to come down here?"
A piece of wall slithered down with a sticky, organic cowpat sort of noise. Little plops and trickles filled the tunnel. Ankh-Morpork's underworld was stealthily reclaiming its own. Angua closed her eyes and concentrated. The slime reek, the vampire's smell, and the water that was now ankle-deep all jostled for attention, but this was competition time. She couldn't let a vampire take the lead. That would be so traditional.
"There were other dwarfs," she murmured. "Two, no, three, four more. I'm getting the black oil, distant blood, down the tunnel, and there are only three bodies here."
She stood up so sharply that she nearly hit her head on the tunnel roof.
"Come on.
It's getting a bit unsafe. We could solve this. Come on. You can't be afraid of dying."
Angua plunged away.
"And you think spending a few thousand years buried in sludge is likely to be fun?" shouted Sally.
But she was talking only to dripping mud and fetid air. She hesitated a moment, groaned, and followed Angua.
Further along the main tunnel, there were more passages branching off. On either side, rivers of mud, like cool lava, were already flowing out of them. Sally splashed past something that looked like a huge copper trumpet, turning gently on the current. The tunnel was better built here than the ones nearer the well, and there, at the end of it, was a pale light, and Angua crouched by one of the big, round dwarf doors. Sally paid her no attention. She barely glanced at the dwarf, slumped with his back against the bottom of the door. Instead, she stared at the symbol scrawled large on the metal. It was big and crude, and might be a round, staring eye with a tail, and it gleamed with the greeny-white glow of worms.
"He wrote it in his blood," said Angua, without looking up. "They left him for dead, but he was only dying, you see. He managed to make it to here, but the killers had shut the door. He scratched at it, smell here, and there's blood under all his fingernails. Then he made that sign in his own warm blood and sat here, holding the wounds shut, watching the worms turn up. I'd say he's been dead for 18 hours or so, hm?"
"I think we should get out of here right now," said Sally, backing away. "Do you know what that sign means?"
"I know it's a mine sign, that's all. Do you know what it means?"
"No, but I know it's one of the really bad ones. It's not good seeing it here."
"What are you doing with that body?"
Sally backed away further.
"Trying to find out who he was," said Angua, searching the dwarf's clothing.
It's the sort of thing we do in the watch. We don't stand around getting worried about drawings on the wall. What's the problem?
Right now, said the vampire, he's oozing a bit.
If I can stand it, so can you.